Thank you. My name is Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic. I don't know if they got a sound system. Can you hear me okay? Okay, good. Can you hear me now? Anyway, thank you for having me here tonight. Appreciate being asked to come and spend an afternoon, evening with you. I'm curious, before I get started here, how many people here, just by show of hands, are in their first year of sobriety? Wow. Well, you're the reason I came, really. I think that I was talking to somebody before we started all of this, and I think that, as I boil it down, the only reason we do this are for the newcomers. Because I stop and I think back about when I was brand new, and I wanted really desperately to believe in this, to believe that stuff I was reading in the big book, to believe what my counselors were telling me, what the doctors were telling me, and what I was hearing from fellow patients. I really wanted to believe that. Things I was reading, the 12 and 12, and all of those things. And I wasn't really in any kind of condition to rebut it or to resist it based on the things that had happened that had gotten me there. But I still had those little lingering doubts, you know, that does this really work? When I leave the treatment center after 20 to 30 days, and I go out there in the real world, is everything that I've learned in here going to apply? Is it really going to work? How about when I leave an AA meeting and I go back and get my car, or I get out there on the streets and sidewalks of real life, you know, does this, all these things really work? And so I heard the speakers, and I heard enough of them where I thought, you know, it does. It translates to the real world. And so I think that's really just what my job is here tonight, for the newcomers to get to see, you know, real live, up close, three-dimensional living evidence and proof that this program works. So this stuff that we study about and talk about in the meetings actually translates to the miracles out there in the rest of the world. So that's what I hope to do tonight. Excuse me. I've been fighting a cough. My sobriety date is March the 7th of 1990. And typically, my talk centers around the last 3 days of my drinking career, March 7th, 8th, and 9th. And those days were incredibly intense. Very intense. And kind of like 3 days of the Kennedy assassination, and even to this day, I can look at my watch, and I know where I was at that particular hour on that particular day. It's been 26 years now, and the intensity, I'm sure, has eased somewhat, but not enough that I can tell it. And so on March 7th, 8th, and 9th, I'm at home, and I look at my watch, and I think, boy, I know what was taking place right now, and am I glad I'm here now instead of back there then. And, you know, we're supposed to talk about what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. I hear a lot of speakers, and I used to do it, and I don't think it's a big deal to say what it was like. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now. But I got a real cryptic email a few years back from some guy in Southwest Georgia, who identified himself as an old-timer, and he said, I got one of your CDs here, and I'm listening to it with some newcomers, and you're misquoting the big book. And I thought, what's he talking about? I don't quote the big book. I've got some friends and speakers that go up, and they tell you, page 63, the third paragraph, and I don't have that gift. Although sometimes I'll make reference to the second paragraph on page 132, just so you go, look, I don't have any idea what's there. But I thought, what's he talking about? And he said, you're saying what it was like instead of what we're like. And I thought, oh, really? Really? But, you know, I put my A face on and sent him back an email and said, well, I'm sorry, I'll try not to do that again. Apparently, that didn't have what he was looking for. I get another email back, and he says, maybe the ring of sincerity wasn't quite there, but I get another email back, and he says, well, it's really important. You know, if there were some of us old timers were sitting on the front row and you started that way, we might just get up and walk out, thinking that if you're going to start by misquoting the big book, the rest of the message can't be that good. And so that kind of tweaked my competitive spirit. My A face came off. And I sent him back an email. And I said, you know, since this seems to be bouncing back and forth, I think I should remind you that when we read how it works, it doesn't say, rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly memorized the book. So I didn't get any, I stopped the emails. And but you know, AA has its own way of doing things, and I went down there about 3 years later to the Flint River Roundup, and he was my host. we were good friends, but for whatever reason, I've never said what it was like. I still don't think it's a big deal, but some people do. So I'm going to mix the order up a little bit, and I'm going to start with what happened, because it was the thing that triggered so much activity and media sensationalism. On March the 8th of 1990, an event occurred that had never reached the public's attention before, and that is that three airline pilots were arrested for having flown from Fargo, North Dakota, to the Twin Cities of Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, and I was the captain of that flight crew. Now, I get around a little bit, and it's not very common when a speaker walks away that anybody knows what he or she did for a living, because that's not part of the recovery story, so it's not necessary that it be included, and rightfully so. I have to talk about it because it was the centerpiece of the story. It was the thing that drove the media sensationalism. I was the very first pilot ever arrested, tried, sentenced, and sent to prison for having flown under the influence of alcohol. Now, that's happened a bunch since my incident in 1990. It's happened so much that it's old hat. It's hardly even news. I mean, you'll see somebody's picture on either on TV or in a paper one day, and the day two, it's not there anymore. The news cycle is gone. It's old. But I can guarantee you, when my situation happened and I was the first pilot, this was a huge deal. This had never happened before, and the media got on this, and they stayed on this thing forever. I didn't think it was ever, ever going to go away. We were detained for 12 hours that day, and it was a very surreal day. I couldn't believe this was happening to me. This wasn't who I was. It wasn't supposed to happen to me. But I'm an alcoholic, and it happened to me. I'd spent an entire lifetime trying to do my best, trying to always excel, trying to always go the extra mile, trying to always... I'm going to talk about two parents who were alcoholics and died from this, but before they died and before the alcohol killed them, they taught me and my sister some really good things. And so I never go to the podium without expressing my thanks and my indebtedness to these two people who died from alcoholism. Because one of the things they had instilled in me was a very strong work ethic. And they had told me that I should always, no matter what the job was, no matter the job, how minor, menial, or whatever it was, I should always do it better than the people around me. If I had an 8-to-5 job, I was supposed to show up at 7:45, and I wasn't supposed to leave until 5:15, and I was supposed to work harder than you did during the time that I was there. That was a credo that I had been taught, and it was the thing that kind of pretty much drove my life, that whatever I did, I should leave it with a shining air of dignity and well done. And suddenly, in one night in Fargo, North Dakota, I have shamed and disgraced and violated everything that I ever held dear. Everything that ever had any value to me, I disgraced and dishonored. my family, my profession, my heritage, my company, everything. And I can tell you that from the moment I walked off the airplane and I saw airport police and Northwest Airlines company officials, I was saturated with shame. It was instant, and I mean it went all the way to the bone marrow. I used to try to, when I was talking, I thought it was really important that I convey exactly how deep that was. And so I would search for words to try to describe it. And the big book says it in a very short, succinct way that I think is better than anything I could ever come up with, when it talks about pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Now, Northwest was the only major carrier that had not signed up in the industry for a program for alcoholic pilots. All the other major carriers had those, and those programs dated back to the mid-70s. But Northwest had steadfastly resisted and refused to have anything to do with that program. So every few years, I would see some pilot get in difficulty because his party time, we all partied hard and played hard and all of that. But if it came to the company's attention through some kind of an incident, then they were summarily, swiftly terminated. And those stories swept the airline pilot and flight attendant ranks like wildfire. I mean, they just cut through. And so every few years, 5-6 years, that would happen. And I remembered the names and the locales and the details as best we'd been given them. And so we had this little hall of shame. And during the course of that 12-hour day, among the millions of thoughts that I had, was that's where my legacy goes. That's how I leave this airline. And I had a lot of trouble with that. I'd been the guy in my family. I had three kids who were grown and gone. I'd been the guy in my family who hammered duty, honor, country. Character, honesty, integrity. Do the right thing. I'd been the standard bearer for that. But the very actions that had occurred to me destroyed all that. It rendered all the things that I tried to tell my kids for all the years they were at my home hollow, meaningless, null, and void, based on the personal example I just set. And that took a toll on me, big time. We were released. We went to two different facilities and gave blood. It was at the second facility that there was a reporter who saw uniformed cops, uniformed pilots, and thought there might be a story there, and that's how it broke to the public. Now, I was completely unaware of that at the time. But the mere idea that this was going to go through my friends, my peers, my airline, was really more than I could deal with. I had no idea it was going to go all over the world. Stay in the United States, Canada, and I heard from people in Asia and Europe. Nor, of course, did I know it was going to go on the late-night comics routine and I was going to get to see what that was all about. So I'm one of those guys, I'm no goody-two-shoes, but I don't laugh at the jokes. Tiger Woods jokes, I got saturated with those. I said, look, please just don't send them to me. Enjoy them if you wish to, that's fine, that's your stuff. But I know what that feels like. I know what it feels like for the family members. I'm certainly no goody-two-shoe, but I don't want any part of that. I've been there. So I have an understanding of what that feels like. Interestingly, in a story that I don't have time for, Jay Leno called me in June of 96 and apologized. Let me tell you that in the time that I'm going to be here, and I'm trying to watch a timer to be cognizant and aware of the time, you're going to hear about 30% of the story. There's just too much. Just too much. And I can tell you, on the day of the arrest and the few days that followed that, if there was a story to be had, and if I was ever going to tell it, it would take 5 minutes because my life was over. It was completely, totally, absolutely, without question, over. No one ever came back from an incident like this. Not one that I saw. And theirs were only about 10% as bad as mine turned out to be. Nothing had ever happened that was this serious and severe. I got home that night, when I was finally released, I called home and I thought, first time that day, it occurred to me, I'm supposed to be home right now. I was supposed to be home. Barbara waited for me over at the airport for 4 hours and was still there when I called home to say I wasn't going to be in there, and left a whispered message that there had been a disaster. I thought I'd lost my job. I'd be home the first flight in the morning. I don't know why she didn't call me back, having gotten a message like that. But later I looked at it and I thought, what a gift that was, because I was so sick at heart, I didn't want to talk about this. I just didn't want to talk about it. I got home the next morning on the first flight. Exited the airport. I knew everybody at the airport. I knew the agents, the mechanics, the baggage handlers, the groomers. And used to laugh and joke and talk with them. I didn't want anybody to see me, stop me, or anything. I needed to clear the area, and I got out very quickly. I've never told the story, but what I ever said, when I exited, I saw Barbara parked off to the right. I felt like I had to climb over the curb to get in the car with her. God, the shame was just dripping from me. She and I had been married a long time. I couldn't look at her. I could not turn and look at my wife. I was so ashamed. And all I could say was, as she pulled away from the curb, was, honey, I'm so sorry. She's got a very soft South Texas voice, and she said, who better than I could possibly understand how you might feel right now? And we drove home in silence. Again, another gift that I didn't recognize for a while. Because later I thought, what wife, having learned that her husband had just trashed a 22-year golden career as an airline captain, the thing I'd worked my entire life to get to, would not have said, why did you stay? You've seen this before. You know the Northwest policy. Why didn't you go back to your hotel room? All good questions. And I didn't have an answer for any of them. She went to work, and I called a doctor. He was a PhD family therapist. He was the only person I knew to call. I said, there's been an emergency, and I need to come in and see you right away. And he cleared the calendar and said, come straight in. So I drove to his office, and he's just like, I'm just there 5 minutes ago. I can still see it. And I walked in, and the thing about all of this was that this was the thing that finally did me in. I was done at this point. I was beaten. I was destroyed. I was devastated. I was shredded. So I had no more resistance. And I walked in, I just told him straight out what happened. This is now Friday, March the 9th. I'm going to hear two statements that day that I can't mentally process. And I heard the first one because he started around his desk and he stopped me, looked at me. He said, wow, this is horrible, horrific. He said, but maybe this is what had to happen. I had no idea why he would say that to me. I could not put that in context for anything. I thought, why would he say that to me? And he left and came back a few minutes later and he said, I've got an appointment set up for you tonight at 6 o'clock. Crosstown, Atlanta, a very prominent doctor. He's a psychiatrist. He's a recovering alcoholic and cocaine addict, and he's certified in addiction medicine. And I did not know what addiction medicine was. I'd never heard of it. Now, I picked up on the 6 o'clock time. Even in the condition I was in, that registered. Because I knew doctors didn't see patients at 6 o'clock on Fridays. Later, this doctor told me, he said, based on your appearance, he said, I was so afraid you were a suicide. And he said it was important, vital, that we get you over there as soon as possible. And I don't know what I looked like or sounded like, but already I'm starting to have some dark thoughts. Barbara and I drove across town to this doctor's office. I have absolutely no memory of that meeting. I hadn't had anything to eat or drink for 2 days, and that entire meeting is just like an alcoholic blackout, and I've had a lot of those. I can't explain that. I don't know why. All I know is anytime he asked me a question, I gave him a straight answer as best I could. At some point in that interview or that period, he looked at me and he said, Lyle, he said, you're an alcoholic and you need to get into treatment tonight. And I didn't react. And that was significant because I've hated alcoholics. I've hated them since I saw what two parents were and what it did to my family. I've hated them since I grew up in the Native community and I saw what it did there. I saw it when I flew around the country with the bums and the drunks in the alleyways and the dirty clothes and the brown paper bags and passed out on the grass and laying on benches. Those were alcoholics. That was my version, my definition of an alcoholic, and I was not an alcoholic. Except in the 24 hours since the arrest in a way I'll never understand. All the dots way down deep got connected. And I knew. I knew I was that thing that I hated so much that I swore I would never be. That I fought against. I was an alcoholic. Different than my parents in the way that I acted and behaved and maybe drank, but still an alcoholic based on what it did to my life. Now, I hear all kinds of stories in moving around the country a little bit, and I've often thought, you know, if you're a newcomer and you're coming here, you've got plenty of grist to say, I am not an alcoholic because I didn't do that, and I didn't do this, and I didn't do that. Our stories are all over the place. Our drinking patterns vary. They're diverse. Our facts and circumstances are all different. But I hear my story in every alcoholic story that I've ever heard, every speaker. Because I don't listen for facts and circumstances. I listen to hear what the disease does, what it takes from that person in terms of loss, pride, self-esteem, both material losses and internal losses, which are the greater, I think, and the devastation that it sows on everything. And then I listen for the recovery part of it. And if I'm listening for all of that, I'll hear my story in the story. Never mind the surrounding facts and circumstances. I looked at this doctor and I said, I thought you would probably tell me that, and I'm okay with it. And I said, I just got home today. I said, please let me go home. I said, I'd like for Barbara to just hold on to me and just let my mind uncoil. Let me absorb what's happened to me, and then I'll go into treatment. He said, you need to go into treatment tonight. And I paused and looked at him. I said, okay. So we turned around and we drove across town to a treatment center that I, of course, never heard about. And I had no reason to know anything about it. I went in there with the clothes on my back. We made the final turn for that treatment center. Of course, it was dark and the headlights hit the sign and I hit the brakes. The sign was right in front of me. And the reality was right in front of me. It said, Anchor Hospital. Hospital for Alcoholism and Other Chemical Dependencies. I was like somebody just kicked me right in the guts. The reality of looking at that sign. Because I said, this is where my life ends. My life ends tonight in a treatment center for alcoholics. And I'm thinking to myself, my God, what happened? What happened? How can this be? I had a little flashback of some of the really neat times and accomplishments in my life, most of them against the odds. These were precious things to me. And I wasn't even sure at that moment if they ever existed or if they'd just suddenly been erased. I read a summarizing paragraph sometime later at the end of a lengthy doctor's report. I said, given the history and background of this man, it was unlikely to believe he would ever be a productive member of society. And I looked at that and I thought, my God, that is really dismal. And then I thought, well, I was the one that gave him all the information. We started down the hill into the treatment center, and for the first time that day, it occurred to me, this is March the 9th. This is my 27th wedding anniversary, the day after the arrest. And I said, hell of a way to spend an anniversary, huh? I then heard the second statement that I couldn't fathom or process. Very softly, Barbara said, might be the best one we ever had. And I thought, who could think that? My life is gone. There's no question. My life is gone. There will be no coming back from this. How could she manufacture a thought like this at a moment like this? And I didn't respond. I'll break this up a little bit. Tell you, a few years ago, March the 9th rolled around. It was a gorgeous Georgia day. And about 9 in the morning, one of my sponsees pulls up this long, winding driveway where we live. Surprising me. And he said, yeah, I've heard the story. It's March the 9th. I thought I'd come by and wish you guys a happy anniversary. So he came inside. Barbara's got coffee going. We're laughing and talking. And he said, what's the secret to having stayed married so long? And I didn't get a chance to say anything. Barbara said, mostly due to the fact that I could never stand to admit I made a mistake. I'll share something with the newcomers. You'll hear, and it's true, that this is an ego-deflating program. It's not necessary you tell your wife or your significant other that. because that's the best part of the program as far as Barbara's concerned. And so she's always on task and on duty. About 2 years ago, I think it was, I was speaking at the Whitworth Women's Prison. Been there a number of times and going back again. And you got a vision of this. This is a women's prison. And these are some pretty hard-looking ladies. They are not like you gals out there. These are oversized scrub, khaki scrubs, and no makeup, and hard-looking tattoos, and some body piercings, and just a rough-looking bunch of gals. And I'm getting into the story a little bit. And all of a sudden, one of them yells out, "You're hot." That's never happened before. And it just stopped me in my tracks, and I'm trying to recover. And two or three more of them yelled out, "Yeah, you're hot." I regroup, and I get through the story. And by the time I get home, it's, I don't know, 1 in the morning or so. Barbara's asleep. The next morning, she gets up, and we got a coffee. I think she needs to hear this. And so we're having coffee, and I told her about it. And she looks at me and takes a sip of coffee, and she says, "They must have been locked up a really long time." See, what we get to do here tonight, like we just did, is laugh. We get to laugh. That's one of the greatest gifts of recovery. Because I've never seen anybody laughing when they came in for their first AA meeting. I've never seen anybody laughing on that occasion. I wasn't. It was a long time before I could even smile. Let me start and kind of fill in some blank spots here and tell you, I was born in Wichita, Kansas, in September 1938, so I got 78 coming up here pretty quick. It's not a big deal for me, it's just a big number. Got here awfully fast. I tell you that because I'm always, I know that I'm not the only one that sits out there and tries to figure out how old the speaker is. And I always do it, and usually I'll do it because there are dates and places and things that can be connected before the hour's up, and so I've got it pretty well figured out. Except the ladies are, the A ladies and the Al-Anon ladies are devious, and I don't know how they do this or why, or if it's a plan or they just comes naturally, but they will say things that are completely off-center, off-track, you got to figure, and they'll say something like, "I graduated from college," and I'm thinking, well, she's got to be 21 or 22. The same year Kennedy was assassinated, I'm going, that was 63, I think, so minus 21. Or I had my first child, I was 24, and it was 2 years after Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. And I'm going, was that 68 or 69? So I'm adding, subtracting, and debiting, and crediting, and she walks away, and I go, I don't know, she's either 43 or 68, one of the other. So I just get it out of the way. I grew up in a World War II housing project called Plainview on the southeast edge of Wichita, Kansas. It's a very economically depressed area. I wouldn't call it a ghetto, it's just economically depressed. And poor is a very subjective term. That can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. If I'm on a reservation someplace and I'm looking at houses with corrugated tin roofs or places that don't have running water, we're never poor by those standards, but we didn't have anything. And everything we owned was third-rate, broken, bent, patched, taped, wired, and we were all struggling to catch up. And this was during the 50s, and I can tell you that those are the happiest days of my childhood. I have great memories of that time because we were all the same. It was before the advent of drugs, and nobody I knew did drugs. We drank, and smoking, of course, was prevalent. I never even smoked, but we didn't have any gangs. We didn't have any drive-by shootings. And in spite of the fact that we were a commingled bunch of blacks, whites, Hispanics, and small Native American segment, we all got along. Rarely did I ever see or hear about a police call out there in Plainview. So it was a happy time in my life. And I'm an ethnic mix of several different things, part of the Native community there. The two parts that really seem to show up when I pop the bottle top of a bottle of whiskey are the Irish and Comanche parts. They like to drink. And you know, I don't have a chance to, you know, clearly I'm not full blood, and I can't go out and pick my parents, so I thought it was an okay combination because I love those Irish freedom songs or those spirited songs, and I'd had the albums and knew the songs. And so I'd fly around the country. And if there was a, it doesn't make any difference, Washington, D.C., Boston, Chicago, wherever, if they had a live Irish place, I knew where it was, and within 5, 10, 15 minutes of getting to the hotel, I changed clothes and I was there. And I would sit there and drink and sing along those songs until, and I would literally go out the door with the band. I would stay there until they were all finished up. And then there might be other times and other places where things were different. Those places may not be available. Maybe my mood was different, and the other part would kick in, and I just have this strong urge and say to myself, this would be a good evening to go out and have a few drinks and kill some white people. And I always hoped that didn't kick in when I was in those cowboy bars in Montana. That's a rough night if that happens. I was active in my native community. It's a strong part of my identity. I grew up in the powwow community, the songs, the traditions. I was a dancer. I have gone back to that since getting sober, and I'm dancing again, and I'm active in Native American, what we call Red Road programs. And that's refreshing to see. Two of my Native brothers are here tonight, and I told them it makes it special when they show up. When they show up, it puts a special veneer on the whole evening for me to see sober Indian people. Because I didn't see them growing up. I suppose there were some older traditional people that were around, but they weren't where I was, and I wasn't where they were. And so when I came back to the Native community, and I tell a different story in front of the Native community, I was surprised to see some modicum of sobriety movement starting inside the Native American community. It's long overdue, and a lot of us have died from this. When I was 14, the alcoholism had done its work with both my parents, and they divorced. A lot of bad things happened to my family. A lot of really bad things happened to my family. And within about 3 years, each of them had been married and divorced two more times. And I didn't get along with step-siblings and blended families I just wasn't part of. And I'd have problems and be asked to go to another family. And then I'd bounce back and forth. And I'd travel back and forth. And faces would change. Names would change. I don't remember any of those people. Would not know them if they came into the room tonight. I graduated when I was 17 years old. Not too many people went to college from the area I grew up in. And Wichita is known as the air capital of the world because Boeing, Beach, Cessna were there and a couple of other places at the time. So most of my friends married their little high school sweethearts and went to work in one of the aircraft factories. I wasn't going to do that. I wanted to go in the service, but I wasn't sure quite what I was going to do. About that time, one of my friends came back from the Marine Corps right out of boot camp, and I was impressed. He and I sat in a bar for several hours one afternoon, and he regaled me with these sadistic, cruel, brutal stories of what Marine drill instructors do to their recruits in boot camp. I've just turned 18 at that point, and it's probably an early sign of not so good thinking, but I'm thinking, man, I just can't wait to go do that. And within a few days, I had signed, and off I went. There are a couple of common themes I hear in a lot of these stories, and they're true for the people who come to the podium and tell you they are not true for me. One of them is I never fit in. I never felt like I fit in. The other part is I took that first drink, and boy, the magic happened. Neither one of those are true in my story. I didn't like the taste of the first drink, didn't like the taste of the last drink. I liked what it did. But I went into the Marine Corps, barely age 18, and once I got over the initial shock of it, I snapped in pretty quickly. I loved it. It was exactly where I needed to be. I fit in. I felt it. I belonged. And I experienced that thing that the Marine Corps is known for, that sense of brotherly camaraderie. I had never experienced that sense of belonging so intensely. And I got it there. And I thought, this is what I want to do. I want to be a Marine. And at the end of the 13 weeks, the drill instructors, there were about 70 of us, called out three names. The three top guys in the platoon, and my name was the second name called. I was stunned. I was surprised. I was so proud. I didn't know that. I had no idea. And I got a PFC stripe, private first class. Now, you do not run the Marine Corps as a private first class. But I had that stripe. I just couldn't take my eyes off of that red bordered stripe. And my buddies, there's 67 of them, don't have anything. They're slick sleeves. And I got that PFC stripe. We go to Camp Pendleton. Immediately draw guard duty. They're out in the rain with a rifle on their shoulder. I'm inside a warm Quonset hut because I got that stripe. I'm acting corporal of the guard. And I remember looking at the corner, and there was a first lieutenant's uniform over there. I saw the silver bar. And I looked at it, and I thought, by God, at the rate I'm moving up, general is not that far away. So I stayed, and I excelled. Now, one of the things you're not going to hear from me tonight because of the interest of time, because I've only got another 2 hours and 10 minutes. So I can't do a long drunkalogue. I think they're important. I think they're vital for identification purposes. I either got to talk about the rest of it or the drunkalogue. My drunkalogue's pretty much like everybody else's. I drank a lot of stuff for too long. I had a lot of blackouts. I woke up in places. I didn't know how I got there. I got into fights. I lost cars. Didn't know where I'd left those. I had two DWIs separated by about 5 years. And throughout the course of all of these things that happened, my mantra was that could happen to anybody. That could happen to anybody. And I thought it was true until I got into treatment. I do a first step deal. I've got pages of things. I go, that it can't all happen to one person. And anyway, I had those two DWIs. They were separated by about 5 years. I got a good Indian buddy who was talking. He said he was in court for his sixth DWI before he learned that that did not stand for drinking with Indians. Now, my drinking accelerates over the course of my lifetime. This is a chronic progressive disease. We don't all progress at the same rate. Ladies accelerate faster for biological reasons. But we don't, even given that, we still don't get there at the same rate. So it took me a while. But I'm always in a hard drinking environment. So it's hard to see that my drinking is different from somebody who is normal. I was a young Marine, supposed to drink hard. Later, I'm a fighter pilot, supposed to drink hard. Later, I'm an airline pilot. We party hard. But eventually, I pull away from the crowd. Eventually, my drinking does. And I clearly remember that. I clearly remember in the latter parts, before the wheels all came off, sitting down with a bunch of my friends drinking, and I'm thinking, God almighty, these guys drink slow. I'd have two or three drinks lined up in front of them. I'm throwing mine down. I'm going, can't you talk and drink? And I'd leave, and I'd be embarrassed for them. I'm thinking, God, I hope that never happens to me. I remember watching my drinking accelerate quickly. Throughout the entire time I excelled in the Marine Corps, I came in 4.5 years later. My commanding officer took me into his office, and he said, there's a new program out called Marine Aviation Cadet, and you're the only guy in the unit whose entry scores are high enough that you might go and test for that if you're interested. I'd always wanted to fly. I was a kid that built little stick model airplanes all the time with a little amount of money that I was allowed to keep from my jobs. But flying was never on my radar. Pilots, as far as I knew, had to have college educations, and they came from other parts of Wichita, and they came from good families. They didn't come out of a World War II housing project, a native segment, an alcoholic home with a marginal high school diploma. That just didn't fit. But he's telling me I can go test, and I went over and tested, and I passed. And I came back, and he said, the thing that you need to understand is this is an 18-month program. He said, traditionally, about half the people don't make it. And you're coming in the back door as an enlisted Marine via the test you just took, and everybody coming in from the civilian side, about 99%, have to have 2 years college just to get into this program and begin it. And those will be the people that you'll be competing with. So I knew that I had a good chance of not making it, but I wanted to try. I came home to Wichita. They were having a powwow. I went out, and the Kiowa family that I had grown up with called for a special. It's something we do, because I'm going to Pensacola the next day. And so I led the special around the arena. And all the way to Pensacola the next day, I was really imprinted and impacted by that, because I thought, there's no way that I can come back to this community as a failure. I cannot come back early and say, I'm home, because I flunked out. I washed out. I couldn't hack it. I'm back. I was driven with that throughout the entire 18 months. And there were four phases of flight training at that point in time. And through every one of those phases, I was a number two guy. And through every one of those phases, it was a surprise and a shock. And I didn't feel it, and I wasn't confident. I didn't think I was doing as good as my grades. I was watching my friends wash out weekly, sometimes daily. And the looks on their faces, they never met my eyes when they came over to say goodbye with a sea bag over the shoulder, and they walked away. And every time they walked away, I thought, at some point, that will be me. But I know how to work, and I never let up. I'm indebted to my parents because I know how to get down in the mud and get in there and work and sweat. And I did. I worked harder than a lot of my peers did because I had more to lose, I thought. The final 6 months, we left Florida. I went to Beeville, Texas for advanced jet flight training. If I could just complete the next 6 months, I had it made. I could do it. The first night into town, I got together a bunch of my buddies in the officers club. We got rip-roaring drunk. They said, let's go into town. There's a little old-fashioned drive-in in there. That's where the good-looking South Texas girls hang out. And we've got an inside track because we're going to be hotshot jet fighter pilots. So I went with them. I was never very gutsy with the gals, but I had a lot to drink. And they immediately went after a carload of girls, and I kind of hung back. And I could see the driver at an angle, but I couldn't really get a good look at her. She wasn't talking to anybody. So I'm back there drinking, and I'm watching her, and I'm rehearsing some things that surpass my normality level of whatever. And I'm thinking, God, I don't know how I came up with this, but this is deadly stuff. She may even just take her clothes off when I walk up there. And so I go sauntering up to her window, and she turned and looked at me, and she was a pretty lady, pretty girl. And everything just went, shoom, and it left. And I'm standing there flat-footed and empty. She's looking at me, and I'm looking at her, and she's got brown eyes. And I said, you got the prettiest brown eyes I've ever seen. Hardly a deadly pickup line, and especially when it came out. I said, that's a good surprise. And she looked at me like I just peed on the side of her car. And I turned around and walked away. I was so embarrassed. Later, I thought, nobody that drunk should still be embarrassed, but I was. So I thought, I'm not going back. So I'm back there drinking. And a little while later, she got out and went into the ladies' room, and I got a good look at her all the way in there. And I had an AA thought. Now, I didn't know it was an AA thought, and I didn't, but I recognized it about 29 years later when I heard it, because she's walking in there, and I'm walking. And I thought, God, she's got nice legs. She's got that cute butt and those turquoise shorts. She's got that pretty face, those brown eyes. I want what she has, and I'm willing to go to any length to get it. I had a run-in with her, an accidental encounter with her the next day. She had a friend with her. I had a buddy with me. We went into this place. I saw him go in, and I was nervous and scared, but I was sober. And she let us buy him some coffee, and we talked for a little bit. And she told me her name was Barbara. And on February the 25th, 1963, her 20th birthday, she pinned these gold wings right here over my heart. She pinned two gold bars on my shoulders. Hollywood couldn't have scripted a better day. I had completed. I could go home. And I had this good-looking girl who thought I was okay. So we drove home to Wichita for a three-week leave. She stayed with my sister. And as it was coming to an end, she's going back to Texas. I've got orders to California. And I called her and I said, I don't want to lose you. I said, let's go down to Oklahoma and get married. So we ran down to Newkirk, Oklahoma, and stood in front of a justice of the peace and got married. And March the 9th just passed was number 53 for us. So she, as long as she can't stand to admit that she made a mistake, I think I've got a place to stay. She joined me in California. She was the youngest wife of the Marine Squadron, 20 years old. She was instantly pregnant, which I thought was part of my Marine Corps duty. And we had a little baby boy, and 8 days, less than a year later, we had a second one. And people come up and go, you guys Catholic? And I go, no, we're just horny Protestants. We don't. About that time, I've got orders to Vietnam. We were one of the first jet squadrons into Vietnam. We flew out of a little place called Chu Lai, 50 miles south of Da Nang. It was a very primitive, typical Marine Corps combat operation. In the sand, in tents, eating sea rations out of little cans, no ice cubes, no cold water, no air conditioning, you know, nothing. Just primitive creature comforts, no creature comforts. We had a runway that was half of what we needed, this interlocking matting that they used. But we used jet assist bottles for takeoff. All of our landings were into carrier gear, and we were all carrier qualified. We flew under some really difficult and extreme combat conditions, and we acquitted ourselves extraordinarily well. And the idea that I can stand here today and look back and say, out of 28 of the finest men that I've ever known, I got to fly in the middle of them. What a once-in-a-lifetime honor and experience and privilege that was. I'll never see that again. But what a great experience that I got to be with those guys. We still have a reunion every other year, those of us who are still left, and our ranks have thinned considerably. And I get to be with my Marine Corps buddies that I was in a war with. I put in for a regular commission while I was over there. They were very competitive. And I knew full well that the Marine Corps did not give regular commissions to officers with no college. And I got a regular commission. And that is what I'm supposed to do. That's what's expected of me. That's what I expect of me. I'm not supposed to go into a place in Fargo, North Dakota, and become the greatest pariah in all of American commercial aviation. The biggest disgrace and joke in the nation. And that's what I did because I'm an alcoholic. And sooner or later, I don't call the shots anymore. I'd like to. I tried to. I wanted to. But I don't call the shots anymore. I think the greatest tragedy of this disease is not what happens to me. I'm a big boy. I believe when you do what you did, you get what you got. I'm personally responsible. I'm personally accountable. I think the tragedy of alcoholism is the fact that we bring the suffering and the shame to our loved ones. Barbara didn't deserve it. My kids didn't deserve it. My friends didn't deserve it. And then I bring it all to them as an alcoholic. I think that's the tragedy. Barbara and I got out of the Marine Corps finally after 11 and a half years because I was going to be gone from my family for 4 to 6 years, and I couldn't do that to my kids. I'd seen what happened to some of the other senior officers as a result of absentee father situations. And so I sat down. It was a heartbreaking, painful moment for me to resign that commission because I wanted to stay until I either couldn't fly or I died. I got out, and 3 weeks later, I was in class at Northwest Airlines. And for nearly 22 years, I had the same kind of a job situation there. I loved the job. It was fun to go to work. I loved the people I flew with, both in the front and the back. I just couldn't wait to go to work. My drinking was picking up. We got to the airlines, and Barbara and I had talked about adopting a little girl, a child, even before we got married. We had the two boys. And she wanted a daughter, so we decided to adopt. And that was a struggle because we had the two biological boys. We put in a heck of a fight, and 14 months later, we bring home this little Indian girl, little Chippewa girl, but named her Dawn. She was the most beautiful little girl I've ever seen. And I did not know what daughters do to their dads, and I certainly found out. She couldn't walk past me without me picking her up, looking at that beautiful little face and saying, "Thanks for being my girl." She'd say, "Thanks for being my dad." She was the center of my universe. And when she was 17, she ran away from home. I didn't see it coming. Barbara didn't see it coming. I don't know if I was not drinking. One of the things, I had problems thinking I was an alcoholic. Once in a while, I would question whether or not I was drinking too much. But I didn't drink in the mornings, except maybe 3 times out of the year, Labor Day, 4th of July, Memorial Day. And I knew all alcoholics drank in the mornings because I'd seen it on TV. I couldn't stay drunk for 2 weeks or 3 weeks at a time, and I'd heard alcoholics do that. I didn't beat or abuse my wife or kids, not physically. And I knew alcoholics did that. And over the course of time, I came up with a couple of tests to see whether or not I was an alcoholic. Came up with them knowing absolutely nothing about the disease of alcoholism. I just came up. But, you know, there a number of us, pilots are one of the groups that don't have to know anything about something to be an authority on it. And so I came up with these tests, and I passed the tests, and which would certainly surprise a lot of you. They pointed out to me in treatment that most normal drinkers don't feel compelled to come up with tests to see if they're normal drinkers. I got it. Yeah, that made sense. Dawn ran away from home, and I had put off being a captain for 2 years because I didn't want to be a junior captain. I wanted to be there until she finished up high school, and she was coming up on that, and then she was going to go to college, I thought. And so she was coming up for graduation. I went to Chicago to take a special written test to become a captain, and that afternoon when Barbara took me to the airport, she and some of her friends came and got what they wanted and left a runaway note, and Barbara didn't see it until late that night and couldn't call me. I called home the next day, and Barbara told me what had happened. I panicked. I blurted out where to go and who to call and where to look. I was scared to death. My little girl was out there someplace, and I didn't know what had happened to her. It was a 2-hour flight back from Chicago, and I don't know what happened to me on that flight. I'm not aware of any change happening, but something happened because I got off the airplane, and I hated her. I hated her worse than I thought I had the capacity to hate anyone or anything. And I mean, my hatred was white hot. And I told Barbara, I said, "I don't care. I'm no longer concerned about whether she's alive or dead or where she is." I told Barbara, I said, "I don't care if she dies in the streets. I said, she'll never come back to my house to live. And I never want her name mentioned or breathed in my presence as long as I'm alive. And the rest of the family got the word real quick. Within 2 days, everything she'd ever owned or touched in the house was gone to Goodwill. There was no physical trace of anything that bore evidence of her living in my house. I went to the safety deposit box and I ripped up her adoption papers, including a beautiful loving letter from a foster mother who had her when she was, till she was 17 days old, which is when we got her. I ripped that up. I went to an attorney and disowned her. I tried to annul the adoption and couldn't. And in the raging tornadic activity that I was just whirling in, I looked at this, and in a way that's only insanely amusing, I thought, I don't think Barbara's handling this too well. She probably needs a therapist. And so I reached in the yellow pages, and by the luck of the draw, I got a good PhD family therapist. We saw him twice a month for almost 2 years. And I didn't like talking about my daughter. And one time he was trying to get me to talk about her, and these words flew out of my mouth, and I had never consciously formed this thought or these words to the best of my knowledge. But I looked at him and I said, I'm going to tell you something, doctor. I would rather hate than hurt. And he still looked at me. He said, you survived a childhood doing that, and if you continue, it'll destroy you. Everything he told us came true. It just took some time. I got into treatment and I looked at that and I thought, that's exactly what I've done. Because as a man, I'm not going to make myself vulnerable being hurt. I learned that somehow growing up. And so if I think somebody's on the brink of hurting me, I get angry. And the walls come up and they're high enough and thick enough, and you can't hurt me. The pain will not penetrate. I am just angry. And that's what I did. And I saw it once I got into treatment. I went into treatment. And I didn't want anybody to know who I was or what I was. It was a week before anybody knew the color of my eyes. Everywhere I went, my eyes were on my shoe tops. I sat there, and about day two or three, the media had it. Boom, everybody knows. Treatment center had 2 TV sets. I wouldn't go near either one of them because I'm always on there. I'm the lead story every news segment. A week to the day that I go into treatment, they announce on TV, and of course, we got patients whose designated duties come report to me. And they told me I'd been terminated by Northwest. The FAA had done an emergency revocation of all my flight certificates, and I'd lost my FAA medical because of my alcoholism diagnosis. So I'm now stripped of everything. I've got no education to fall back on, and all my aviation credentials are gone. Within 30 days, we were broke. I'd grown up that way. Now I took Barbara with me on the way down. We lost it. I had many wonderful experiences in treatment. Somewhere in the first week, we went into a group room, and I didn't intend to talk or not to talk. I was just there. And they closed the door, and there were 8 or 10 of us in there, and I began to talk about my daughter for some reason. And that wall of anger was not there. And that pain hit me in the heart. And I sat there and cried. And I had not cried at my parents' funerals. I did not cry. My sister sent me an email a couple of years ago and said, I grew up with you. I didn't think anything would ever make you cry. And I cried that day, and I felt so naked and ashamed and embarrassed. It was one of the best things that ever happened to me. And I told Barbara, I said, get together with Don. Let's put the family back together again. There were no visitors, no phone calls to this place. She knew where Don was. Staff said, really, we'll give you a day room. That's such an impossible breakthrough for you. The 2 doctors heard about it and said, could we please come watch? And they were off to the left as I walked in that room. And I saw my daughter for the first time in 2 years. And I thought, my God, she's smaller than I remembered. I did not remember she was that small. I can't tell you what it felt like when I walked over and put my arms around her and told her how much I loved her instead of how much I hated her. Great things were already happening to me in treatment because I was buying into this deal. And it wasn't about her, it was about me. And in her arms is a 5-month-old granddaughter that I really didn't know anything about. My daughter had gotten married, and I didn't even know her last name. Wish I could tell you that everything has been wonderful since then. It's been 28 years now since she ran away from home, and her life is a mess. It's just a train wreck. Not alcohol or drug-related that I know of, but just bad decisions. And it's too bad. It's too bad. We've given her chances, and she's turned them down. And I know the difference between helping and enabling, so we don't throw money at it. She gets $100 on her birthday. She gets $100 at Christmas, and that's it. Not because I want to be cruel or vindictive, but because I know the difference between helping somebody and enabling somebody, and I won't enable even my daughter. about that time, I had to start telling my kids, I'm now getting bad news legally. On the day of the arrest, none of the attorneys, either Airline Pilot Association attorneys or company attorneys, no attorneys knew of any kind of legal consequences that were going to flow from this. I knew the FAA was going to have strong reaction, but now suddenly they're taking me out of the group every other day or so and giving me the latest bad news, and it's about going to jail. I thought the only time I would ever be locked up was as a POW in prison, if I'm in Vietnam, if I was shot down. The idea of me going to a jail is just abhorrent. I cannot fathom going to a jail. And so every time they take me out, it stops my heart. It's like they suck the air out of the room, and I can't breathe, and they're doing it every other day or two or three. The penalties are doubling, and then I go through six of these incidents, and it just smothers me to death almost. And I'm trying to get to that acceptance level, acceptance, acceptance. The sixth time, there was a doctor standing outside there, and I thought, oh, this is bad. We went down there, and he said, Lyle, I have to tell you that in addition to Minnesota charging you, double charging you, North Dakota charging you, double charging you, the federal marshals coming after you, the federal grand jury has just indicted you. You're looking at 15 years in federal prison, a $250,000 fine, and an attorney's coming and Sunday wants $50,000. I didn't have it. He said, I have to ask you if you're going to hurt yourself. And I said, no. Every nerve in my body shorted out. I just went numb. And I went back to my room, and I don't remember falling, but I do remember my head on the side of the carpet. And I was crying for the second time in treatment. And I said, God, I can't do this anymore. I don't have enough for even one more time. Not even one more time. Please help me. I remember I slept that night. I had many incredible, amazing, life-changing experiences in treatment because I bought into this deal. It changed my life. It didn't change what was happening out there, but it changed what was happening in here so that I could deal with what was happening out there. I got out. I was very quickly in a very heavily publicized three-week trial. I wish I had time to tell you the story about my attorney. And I wanted to plead guilty. He said, it's not a good move, not based on the publicity right now. And I'd been told I have to learn to trust and listen. I said, okay. Had an amazing story with his attorney. And I said to him, I'll be found guilty. And when I am, it will be okay. I want you to know it will be okay. 3 weeks, and he worked his fanny off. He wanted to win this case more than anything. 3 weeks, the jury goes out, the jury comes back. I know what that probably means. I'm the captain, everything comes to me first. I stand up, guilty. He flinched, and I reached over and patted him. I said, it's okay, Peter, it's all right. We went back a month later for sentencing. I'd been in treatment with a federal judge, and he used to corner me. He says, some things you need to know. He said, first of all, he said, the sentencing is a charade. He said, you're going to go through some stuff. You'll talk, your attorney will talk, but he said, when we come through the door, the sentence is set. We never change from the bench. We've already read the letters, and we know all the facts, and we never change from the bench. And other judges around the country have told me that's so. They've corroborated the fact that that is so. A day and a half before sentencing, my attorney calls me, and he says, oh, Lyle, I've got some bad news. I thought, God, you've always got bad. He never called me and said, I got some good news. He said, the judge has just notified the media and the other two attorneys that he's going to depart upwards from the sentencing guidelines. He can go all the way to 15 years. And this judge had strong feelings about we drew the toughest judge in the Minnesota Federal District. And this judge had strong personal feelings about this case, and I saw them every day for 3 weeks. And he was entitled to those feelings because what I had been involved in was a horrific betrayal of the public trust. I did not begrudge him those feelings, but I knew I was going away for a long time. And it paralyzed me. I told Barbara, I said, it's step one. I'm powerless over this. I'm powerless over this. I've got to accept what's coming. I cannot change it. And so on that morning, I stood as the first person up, scared, didn't even know what I was going to say as I stood. And I talked about being grateful for the things that happened inside my family. I was grateful to be sober. I had accepted responsibility for this event from day one. I never made an excuse. I had always accepted responsibility. And I couldn't change what had happened. To everyone's dismay, he announced the sentence guidelines were 12 months to 18 months. They could go up to 15 years. To everyone's dismay, he announced a sentence on me of 16 months. Blew everyone in the courtroom away. There's a beautiful story to that that I wish I had time to tell you that came from a federal marshal who was up there, contacted me a few years ago. Don't have time for it. I couldn't believe it. And then the other thing that he did, he sentenced the other two guys to 12 months. About a year later, he told my attorney in chambers, he said, I was going to sentence Lyle to 4 years in prison until he said what he said, and I thought more about him as a human being, his service in Vietnam, and what he was all about, and I came down from the bench. I knew a miracle had happened that morning in the courtroom. I didn't think I would ever know why or how, but I learned that. The other two guys to this day do not know that they were headed for 3 years. They don't know that even to this day. Then he did something. He said, I'm going to leave. He said, this is a complex case. He said, this law has never been used before. Came on the books in 1987, had never been used before. It was not designed for pilots, and so there are complex legal issues. And he said, you three men can remain free until your appeals are exhausted. The other two said, okay. I said, no, I'll go to prison now. You know, this is a first-person story. So you hear a lot about I, me. It's not about I or me. It's about we. It's about us. It's about what you taught me and what I listened as you spoke, and I absorbed what you told me. This is a story about using the 12 steps, every single one of them, and how I do that and when I use them and how I employ those. It's a recovery story. I said, no, I'll go to prison now. I've been convicted. It's time to go. He told my attorney later, he said, I was lost for words. He said, I've never had a defendant before or since do that. I looked at my attorney. I said, he wasn't lost very long. So on December the 5th of 1990, 34 years to the day that I entered Marine boot camp, I checked into the Atlanta Federal Prison. It was inmate 044478-041. I don't tell prison stories from the podium. Audiences love them, but they have nothing to do with my recovery. But I can guarantee you that everything I've learned in recovery had everything to do with how I dealt with prison, the experiences, the situations, the circumstances, and the people. So I went into prison, served 424 days in the prison system, one day at a time, shorter when necessary. I said that one time. A guy came up to me afterwards and said, 424 days? He said, that's nothing, man. He said, I was out there 18 years. I just looked at him and grinned. I said, well, you win. It was a long time for me. The judge put sanctions on me to make sure I never, ever flew again. The FAA had done this thing, but the judge locked the door, closed the door, poured a layer of concrete right over my coffin. I was never going to fly again, not possible. A year after I got out of prison, he lifted those sanctions. Not a 1 in 10,000 chance that that would happen, and he did it. The best part of my story is that I get no credit for it. I don't have the power. I didn't have the power to make him do that. I didn't have the power to stop what was coming my way from the moment of the arrest. Nor did I have the power for the miracles that came later. That was one of them. The moment in the courtroom was another. I don't have that kind of power. The FAA said, if you want to fly again, you start all over again, literally from the ground up. Nobody thought that was possible. I'd never had a private license. I came out of the Marine Corps. I got a commercial license with an instrument rating. But I said, I'll stay sober one day at a time. I'll go after the licenses one license at a time. 10.5 months later, I passed the writtens on all four licenses, and those are difficult. And I had no help, no shortcuts, no cut across. Just hard work. Again, thanks to my parents. I will work. I will do what I need to do. But there's a flying part that comes in play in that, and I looked at that. I'm making $14,000 an hour working at the treatment center in the counseling department. One of the best jobs I ever had, but I'm just barely staying alive. I can't do the flying. It's a deal breaker. I'm done. Northwest pilot gets a hold of me and said, you didn't know it, but I got a flight school. I want you to come up here and live with me and my family free and go through the flight school. I went up there and I spent 44 days, checked in with the Minnesota Department of Corrections because I'm under 13 conditions of probation. Stayed with that man and his family for 44 days. Rained out 14 days. Never quit studying. The remaining 30 days, I flew 78 hours. And I got four licenses back. I had two of them one morning by 11:15, and I'm not sure that that has ever been done before. And when I'm not night flying, I'm in AA meetings because that's where I belong. That's where I belong. That's what has given me back my life and allowed me to do certain things that are beyond me. I came back with those four licenses in my pocket, and I thought, that's great, but I'll never fly again on American soil because I am the most notorious pilot in all of commercial aviation in America. A month later, the licenses physically arrived in the mail. And an hour after they arrived, I got a phone call from the head of the pilot union at Northwest. A grievance had been automatically filed because of my termination. I had never activated it because they were justified in terminating me. I was not going to fight the termination. I did what I did, and I got what I got. This pilot says to me, this is the best phone call I've ever made, because he said three hours ago, John Dasberg, who is the president and CEO of Northwest Airlines, made a personal decision to bring you back and put you in full flight status at Northwest. I sat there with tears streaming down my cheeks. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I had so horribly shamed and disgraced and embarrassed my airline, and the president himself is bringing me back. And then as I thought about it, I thought that level of courage is beyond extraordinary, because he's also betting his career on mine. Because if I go back and I relapse, after the publicity that I had, which was massive, alcoholic in the headlines, if I go back and relapse, the board of directors will oust him so fast and he'll lose his seat on every board he sits on. Why would he take such a chance? I had ample opportunity to talk with him every year for the next 5 years that I was there, and he never gave me a good answer. He just smiled and said, yeah, we talked about that. I went back. I was never supposed to be a captain again. I said, that's okay. That's okay. Let me tell you, I was overwhelmingly welcome back. Everywhere I went, over the course of a 12, 13-day trip, six to a dozen people come up and say, I'm glad you're back. My name is so-and-so. There's always a small segment that thinks we should never get up, and they want to keep their foot on our neck and keep our face in the mud. That's a relatively small segment of the American social fabric, I believe. I think people like to see a comeback. But the miracle's never... Now, Northwest now has a program for alcoholic pilots, and I'm part of it. I'm speaking at United Airlines coming up on my last year. I get another phone call late at night. Wakes me up. Same pilot. He says, John Dasberg just changed your back-to-work agreement. He knows you're coming up on your last year at Northwest. And when you come home, he wants you in the left seat as a 747 captain. I went back and I spent my last year as a captain of the 747. Not because I'm anybody special, but John Dasberg knows, and he said it on ABC Nightline special, Ted Koppel. He said, I knew Lyle wanted his life back. I knew he saw what he, and he knew that I was a sober member of this fellowship. That's why I got to sit in the left seat, not because I'm anybody special. I retired honorably at 98, age 60, it's now 65. And within 2 days, my attorney calls me, and he said, Judge Rosenbaum just called me. He's now chief judge. He has never in 16 years supported a petition for pardon, but if you want to make the attempt, he'll support yours. I had never considered such a thing. The judge wrote a 3-page affidavit that is so chokingly powerful that even to this day, I cannot read all the way to page 3 without getting tears in my eyes. The rest of the paperwork went in, and 2 years later, I came walking in. There were 8 phone messages telling me I just received a presidential pardon. That's better than winning the Powerball. For a federal felon, that is life-changing. It is mega life-changing. And it hangs on my wall. Because I'm an alcoholic. Because I did what you were asked to do. I got a sponsor. I got a home group. I work the steps. I try to be of service when I can. I care about others. That's all I have ever done. There have been no great big Hollywood dramatic moments in my story. Just one day at a time, we read the promises. I heard the promises on day 2, which was a Saturday. My head was down. And they said, and then I started to listen to them because I thought, maybe there's something to this. And they hit that spot that says, no matter how far down the scale, and I thought, that's out, I'm out. It may be true for you, and it may be true for her, but I'm going too far down, so it's not going to apply for me. And I'm telling you, as I try to wrap this up right now, that you haven't heard 30% of what I've been able to live and experience. It's just amazing. And I'm not responsible for any of them. Let me close with something that I'd like to close with, because I think it addresses life as kind of as I view it. It just says simply this: I do not wish you joys without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without a restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom and goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My Comanche name is Yetzitanop. So you know me as Lyle, and I'm an alcoholic, and thank you for letting me share your evening.